This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with author Steve Hendricks about his new book, A Kidnapping in Milan, The CIA on Trial.
Abu Omar, kidnapped from Milan, tortured in Egypt, and then the CIA agents who did it forced to stand trial and convicted. That's the story.
Noam Chomsky will be joining us to talk about his new book, Gaza in Crisis, Reflections on Israel's War Against the Palestinians.
If you want a lucid explanation of Gaza, Israel, Palestine, and where the United States fits in, listen to this interview and read Chomsky's new book.
Stay with us. Michael Smith, we were saddened last week to hear of the passing of Chalmers Johnson.
He was an historian out in California, taught at UCLA, and then down in San Diego for the University of California. He was famous for writing the book Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire. Blowback, obviously, what happened after 9/11 and why. He wrote three other important books, The Sorrows of Empire, Nemesis, and Dismantling the Empire. Johnson was what you might call a traitor to his class. That was a term they used about the Chinese revolutionary Chou En-lai, who was from an upper-class Chinese family. Johnson also, he was a longtime Cold Warrior. He was a consultant to the CIA. Later in life, he realized that he was wrong. He supported the war in Vietnam and then said he was wrong about that. He understood the roots of terrorism and understood the folly of what the United States is doing now. He called it blowback. Of all the scholars, he was one of the great minds that explained what, in fact, has happened to the United States. He'll be sorely missed. At age 79, he led a good, productive life, and we're thankful for his works later in his life.
I really admired his work. I mean, I read an article or part of one of the wonderful books about empire, and of course, he acknowledged that the U.S. was an empire, and he essentially said we're on the way down. Already has a book now. The last book was called The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. So that's the book, and he talks broadly about how empires go down. He says we're going down, and the only question is which way you go down. Do you go down the way Rome went down, which is militaristically trying to keep all your territories together, killing thousands while you do it, or you go down the way England eventually went down, which is to say, let's just get out of here, I mean, after a big struggle. I mean, they were going down, and not try and keep up their huge military and everything else. And he says that's the choice the U.S. has, but of course the choice they seem to be making is the Roman choice and not the United Kingdom choice.
Well, because we can't admit that we're ever wrong, and one would need to do that to exit.
Yeah, no, they just persist. The inertia is scary. The declaration of war and the standard of living of the American people has been enunciated now by Obama with the wage freeze on 2.1 million federal workers. The costs of the war will never go down. Instead, they're going to take it out on the standard of living of the rest of us.
Goodbye, Chalmers Johnson.
Michael, last week we ran an interview about the Sharia law case, and in the last few days we've had an update.
We had the interview with Munir Awad, and he was challenging this new law approved by 70% of the people in Oklahoma that banned the use of Muslim or Sharia law and any international law in the courts or any kind of court, whatever, of Oklahoma. We have happy news to announce, which is there was a victory in the court. And the court starts out by saying, even though 70% of the people approved of this law, throughout the course of our history, the will of the, quote, majority has on occasion conflicted with the constitutional rights of individuals. And the court enters a preliminary injunction saying the law prohibiting the use of Sharia law or international law in the courts of Oklahoma has been held, well, preliminarily enjoined from being used. Essentially, the referendum has been knocked out, and the courts of Oklahoma are back to being whatever normal courts means.
Over the past several years on Law and Disorder, we've covered several instances in which FBI infiltration has been, in our opinion, carried too far.
What it seems happens to me in these cases, these are Muslim young men usually, is the FBI goes into a mosque or sends somebody into a mosque. They may talk to 100 people. They find one young person who they can string along, who may need money, who may have some anger, like a lot of people do, at what the U.S. is doing in Afghanistan or Israel, or like many of our listeners on other issues. And they take vulnerable young people and they slowly string them along. And the question is, do these cases constitute entrapment when they eventually bust that person for supposedly trying to bomb a synagogue, shoot an airplane, or in this case, place some kind of a bomb in a crowded Christmas square in Portland? And what they do is they string these people along for a number of years. And in this case, we have a 19-year-old Somali young man, born in Somalia, but came here when he was three, named Mohammed Osman Mohammed. And they strung him along and they busted him. And when you read his story, it's remarkable and it's really sad, because I think these young people would never do this but for the FBI. And of course, the test is, we call it an entrapment test as lawyers. And the test is the person predisposed to do the crime that he's eventually accused of, or would he probably not have done the crime but for the FBI? It's pretty clear this kid would not have had any materials, nothing. Where's he going to get gallons of whatever at 19 years old to go try and bomb a square in Portland? Many interesting factors, but two very interesting ones. One is, to try and avoid an entrapment defense, the FBI said, well, we gave this kid options. We gave him the option of working as an engineer to help his people, but he wanted to become operational, and he decided he wanted to do a bomb. And that proves that he had a free choice, and it wasn't our pushing him in one direction or another. On that issue, it's really interesting, because the FBI puts in an affidavit in the case, and it's the only evidence we have here. Let's understand this. Only we have the FBI side of the story. And the FBI records everything that they said this kid said to them and did, or much of it. They have tape recordings of all of the conversations.
Except
what, Michael? Except for one.
Except for one, where the FBI sets him up and says they gave him five options, and he took the violent option. That one they did not record. So we've got to accept the FBI's version of this.
Right. So the so-called argument he was given a choice, you know, I can't say it's 100% bogus, but it has all the hallmarks of being bogus.
It smells.
I mean, because all of a sudden they have this great technical equipment and they don't record the key conversation they need to show that he wasn't entrapped. And so they're going to go into court and they're going to say, well, this is what he said to us. And of course, who's going to believe a young 19 Muslim kid from Somalia against the word of the FBI? And so far, sadly, our courts in the United States, the juries, because they're so cowed by all this, and you see why. On the one hand, the FBI is going to say, here's what he was planning. He was planning, in fact, he had actually gone through it with fake stuff, to blow up a square in the middle of Portland. And then they're going to weigh against that this claim that he was entrapped. Now, the interesting thing is, of course, they also never talk about motive in these cases. And this is where we get into the terrorism discussion. And the FBI affidavit itself essentially gives the motive. And what he says is, for his motive, and he's saying this to the FBI agents, apparently, or a video he made shortly before he was going to be supposedly detonating a bomb. And he said, for as long as you, referring to the United States, threaten our security, your people will not remain safe. As your soldiers target our civilians, we will not help to do so. Did you think that you could invade a Muslim land and we would not invade you? So if you want to understand some of the roots of, quote, alleged terrorism or terrorism in this country, understand that what we're doing in Afghanistan has a tremendous blowback effect to the United States.
A Kidnapping in Milan, the CIA on Trial. It's the title of a new book by Steve Hendricks. It's a fast-paced account of the realities of counterterrorism. Hendricks provides the reader with beginning-to-end view of international Islamist terrorist networks in Europe, while examining the questions of justice and the rule of law. He writes in detail about the February 2003 disappearance of the radical imam Abu Omar, and how under the leadership of prosecutor Armando Spataro, Omar was kidnapped and sent to be tortured in Egypt. Hendricks traces Omar's roots in the jihadist world of the Middle East and his travels to Pakistan, Albania, and eventually the rundown fringes of Milan. Rivalries, mistrust, and bad communication are chronicled amid the CIA, the FBI, and the Italian counterterrorism agencies as operatives snatched Abu Omar from the streets of Italy. To take us further into this story, we're joined now by author Steve Hendricks. Steve, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure to be with you guys.
We have lots of questions to ask you, but we'd like to start out with a brief overview, if you would, on the facts concerning the seizure of the Muslim cleric known as Abu Omar from the streets of Milan.
Yes, what happened was the Italian counterterror police had this imam named Abu Omar under very tight surveillance, under suspicion, well, really far more than suspicion, of terrorism. He was one of the ringleaders of a terrorist cell, but not a great, mighty terrorist, sort of a low to mid-level fella. And they were about a month or two away from arresting him once they had gotten all that they could milk out of the intelligence from his cell that they were getting. But one fine February day in 2003, he sets off for his mosque and just disappears. Vanishes, no hint as to where he might have gone or why. The counterterror police ask around as to what might have happened to him. They ask their friends at the CIA, with whom they were actually building their case against Abu Omar to take him to trial. And the CIA says, we have no idea whatsoever what happened to him. Of course, I'm sure that will shock you to know that the CIA was lying. What had happened was they had grabbed him off the street almost literally at high noon. They missed that by just a couple of minutes. Broad daylight, just a block away from one of the busiest streets in Milan, which is Italy's second largest city. You know, they grabbed a guy a block off the Miracle Mile at the lunch hour in Chicago. It couldn't have been a more brazen snatch. They roughed him up, bound him, gagged him, drove him several hours across northern Italy to Aviano Air Base. From there, they flew him on to Ramstein Air Base in Germany, packaged him further, and then sent him to Cairo, where for months and months and months, he was savagely tortured.
Steve, talk about the social roots of guys like Abu Omar. What was it that fashioned them? You had this wonderful description starting in Alexandria, Egypt. What happened to that glorious city, the alienation and rebelliousness of people like Abu Omar, and how they eventually ended up in Milan? What about Alexandria? What's Milan all about?
The Muslim Brotherhood, which really might be thought of as the godfathers of radical Islam, extremist violent Islam, got its start in Egypt. And one of the places it really got its toehold in was Alexandria, which was this cosmopolitan city, in many ways sort of a shining beacon in the Mediterranean of civilization. By that I mean sort of civilized, cultured life. But its great drawback was that although it was this great mix of European and African and Middle Eastern cultures, it was also entirely decadent. And it was only a good time, a good city for the wealthy, for the folks who, for the most part, had come from abroad. The people who were on the bad end of this were the mass, the great majority of Egyptians who lived in terrible poverty, and we're watching, you know, these Europeans and elite Egyptians spending tons of money, having, you know, brothels and drunken bar parties and all this sort of stuff all over their city. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood responds to this, to make the case very, very oversimplified, by saying, you know, the way to get rid of these people, both to overcome our poverty and to get away from their decadence, is to return to a true Islam from which we have strayed. And in doing that, they were able to attract a lot of followers, but they didn't just stop there. They said, you know, Islam is not going to be reborn simply on the strength of its goodness. We have to fight for it. We have to pick up the sword just as Muhammad did. And of course, you know, the rest is history. We know how that all blossomed into the Islamic terrorism we see today. Because of that, the Egyptian authorities, of course, cracked down on many of these radicals, and a great number of them fled all over the world. They scattered. One of the places they landed was, of course, the great place they landed was Europe, because there were many places there, that were many countries that were very tolerant and accepting of letting foreigners into their country. And Italy was one of those. And in the great industrial cities of Italy, Milan being the foremost, for the large part, most of the Muslims who came in to do sort of menial labor. They were like many of our immigrants from south of our border here in the United States. And, of course, once they were there, they often found themselves marginalized in the same way that, say, a Mexican crop worker would in the U.S. That marginalization, in turn, led many of them to be susceptible to these extremist preachers who had found their way to Milan as well.
Let me get you back. I mean, that's an important part of the story. I want to get back to the thread where you left Abu Omar in a prison in Egypt. And we can talk about the torture part there as we go on, but I'm interested in getting to the middle and then the end. Eventually, Abu Omar gets out.
That is correct.
And then what happens?
Tortured for about a year, and then they let him out and say, don't talk about what happened to you.
He goes back and forth in prison, but at some point, there's a sort of heroic figure in the book, and it's a man I've met and talked to, Armando Spataro, who's an Italian magistrate. And he eventually decides to treat this not as a what you would call a routine CIA operation that you look away from, but to enforce an Italian law around kidnapping. So give us some background to that.
Yeah, Armando Spataro is this charismatic and to me, and as it sounds like to you, heroic figure. He had cut his teeth, became a magistrate in the 1970s in Milan. It was a time in Italy that the Italians know as the years of lead, as in the material of bullets, because Italy was almost undergoing a low-grade civil war at that time. Terrorists of the right and the left were both going after, kidnapping, assassinating, bombing, killing hundreds and hundreds of people. Spataro did his formative work as a magistrate prosecuting terrorists of the left. And he treated them not, you know, the way the Bush administration, now the Obama administration, treats, terrorists as people we need to fight in war. He treated them as criminals, he and his colleagues did. And they eventually, through routine police work, through old-style investigation, surveillance, and then eventually arrests and prosecutions and trials, they prosecuted these terrorists out of existence. After that, he went and worked on cases against the mafia, and then with the same strategy there, the mafia obviously hasn't been prosecuted out of existence, but he stopped a great many criminals through this work. So when the kidnapping in Milan happened on his watch, he treated it the same way. He said, it's a crime. I don't care whether the White House carried it out or some mafia henchman carried it out. A kidnapping is a kidnapping. And if we look the other way on it today, then if they can kidnap Abu Omar today, they can kidnap any one of us tomorrow. He put his foot down on the principle of the rule of law. It's something that he believes in very deeply, and he was going to enforce it, as he should, impartially.
Steve, you mentioned in something I read that this kidnapping had the equivalent of Watergate-type implications for the country, in that it was a crime not just against Abu Omar, but against Italy as a whole.
It was. You know, when I speak to Italians about how they feel about this case, you know, that almost universally they say to me, just imagine for a second that our SISMI, which is the Italian equivalent of the CIA, that SISMI dropped into the United States and snatched a guy off the streets in Boston or New York or wherever, who you guys had under great surveillance and were learning very useful things about. We came in and did that and totally botched your investigation. How would you feel about it? Well, needless to say, we wouldn't like that. Italy was almost universally, its people were almost universally opposed, or at least outraged, when they heard about the kidnapping. Interestingly, and to me sadly, what then happened was the various governments of Italy, first of Silvio Berlusconi, who's a rightist, and then center-leftist Romano Prodi after him, and now we're back to Berlusconi again, all three of those governments immediately did what the Bush and the Obama administration have done here in the U.S., which is to say, we can't talk about this, we can't have a trial go forward in courts about this. To do so would violate national security, would reveal secrets of the state, which would make us unsafe against terrorists. And the disappointing thing is that a great number of Italians, just like a great number of Americans, bought this argument, or at least have rolled over and let it happen. Now, Spataro, being independent, could push forward with his trial regardless of what public opinion was. But the fact that Berlusconi and Prodi got so much support for this line, and it's boosted them in other things they've done, is rather depressing.
Steve, one of the parts of the book that fascinated all three of us was the SIM cards. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. When you use a cell phone, you make contact, as we all know, with a cell tower. But you are making contact with a cell tower even when you don't use your cell phone.
This is remarkable. I want to interrupt you for 1 second because I want to mention your book again because it's so fabulous. And this chapter is particularly amazing. The book is called A Kidnapping in Milan, The CIA on Trial, and it's by Steve Hendricks, who we're speaking to, and he's addressing the SIM card issue. Quite an amazing chapter for all of us who think that somehow we have any anonymity left in the world. But okay, Stephen, go for it.
Yeah, you bet. SIM, S-I-M, stands for Subscriber Identity Module. It's a chip that's inside every cell phone. In cell phones, most cell phones in the U.S., it's just embedded in your phone. In European and other cell networks, you can take it in and out, switch it from phone to phone. But anytime you are, you know, traveling around in most cell networks, you know, your phone is making contact with cell towers wherever you go. Well, that's what's happening. It's not just reading the radio waves that come from the cell tower. It's in contact with the tower back and forth, saying, you know, exchanging various codes and things to be ready for if you need to make a call. Well, most cell companies actually keep records of those interactions, those communications between your phone and the tower, so that what these kidnappers foolishly, sloppily did all over Milan and northern Italy was to use their cell phones like teenagers. Not only did they call each other all the time, but they just left their phones powered on, so that when eventually the Italian prosecutors and investigators were able to find, you know, one or two of these people, kidnappers, they were able to track their movements everywhere they went, almost, around Milan and northern Italy. And then by, you know, paying attention to who they called, who called whom, and when they did this, and so on, they were able to unravel this whole network and come up with about two dozen of the kidnappers, almost exclusively tracked down through their sloppy cell phone usage.
Now, this is a fabulous chapter, and it's one I remember I once saw Spataro speak, and he puts a slide up, and he shows, I think, seven cell towers in the area. Is that right?
In the area where Abu Ammar was kidnapped, right. Yes.
There were seven, and I guess what Spataro did is he got all the records, or his predecessor did, or a combination, and they were able to just see who called who and who called each other at exactly the moment in which Abu Ammar is kidnapped, and it's an amazing presentation in the book of that. Michael Smith had mentioned something about what happens when your cell phone is off, and the question people always think, well, I've been with people where they actually take their battery out of the cell phone because they're worried about being tracked. Do you have to do that, or can you just shut off the cell phone?
You ought to just be able to shut it off. Now, I don't know what sneaky things the government is coming up with all the time, but I certainly know that in this case, if the kidnappers had just shut off their phones, they would have been fine.
Could you talk about the trial in absentia of these numerous CIA agents in Italy and what happened?
Exactly. Armando Spataro eventually brought charges against 25 CIA agents and one U.S. Air Force colonel who had coordinated the arrival of the kidnappers at Aviano Air Base. The trial, in great Italian fashion, took 2 years to take place. They sort of meet for a day every 2 weeks and then, you know, decide that's enough stress for them, and then they just come back and do it a bit later. So it took quite a while to happen, but over that time, Spataro displayed all this evidence that we have been talking about cell phones, hotel receipts that they left, credit card receipts, you know, frequent flyer numbers even that some of these guys gave, and was able through all of this to convict 23 of the 26 accused of kidnapping. They received anywhere from 5 to 8 years, depending upon their degree of involvement in the crime. The three who got off were three who worked out of the U.S. Embassy in Rome. The judge decided that because of their work in Rome, they should be accorded a greater degree of immunity than those who worked from, say, the consulate in Milan. Spataro has since appealed those convictions, and it remains to be seen what happens. Now, upon the convictions, of those who were convicted, almost all of them were convicted under aliases that they had used in Italy. In most of the cases, Spataro didn't find their true names. To do that, he would have had to go to the U.S. probably, and he wasn't going to intrude on American sovereignty without permission, the way America had intruded on Italian sovereignty. And of course, the U.S. was not going to help him with his investigation. But if any of these people who were convicted under their aliases, or the few of them who were convicted under their real names, ever set foot in a country of the European Union, because the arrest warrants, the convictions are good throughout the whole EU, they are to be arrested immediately and sent to Italy to serve their prison sentences.
What attracted you from the start to the Abu Omar case, and how did you do your research on this? The details are remarkable.
What moved me to write this book more than anything was outrage over our inhumanity. I wanted to write a book that had something to do with the war on terror. I knew that. I'd spent the previous 4 years working on a book that I thought was important. It was about how the FBI undermined the Indian rights movement of the 1970s.
Wow, good for you.
Wanted to do something that was more topical and current. I wanted to write about the war on terror, and I felt that I hadn't read any accounts that showed people deeply enough, viscerally enough, what this torture was that we were carrying it out. Why torture, as we carry it out, is not just a crime, but a crime against humanity. And that's what motivated me. There are, of course, many cases of people who have been tortured, but it's very hard to get their stories. So I needed an account where there had been some digging done. And as I looked around at the various renditions and torture by proxies that we have done, I came across this case in Milan. And I was able to get into, you know, the depth of the story because Armando Spataro had gone out and done all of this investigative work and dug up an amazing number of details. I won't say that he had done all my research for me, but he had done things that only a person with the power of a whole judiciary behind him could do. No investigative reporter could have gotten this story without him. And as I got into the story, while I did want to write about torture, and while I am particularly proud of my chapter detailing the torture that happened to Abu Omar, I also became entranced with all of this work by Spataro and his team, and that drew me into it. And of course, then gave me, you know, a whole book, essentially, to write about rather than, you know, just one chapter on torture.
I want to talk about the torture and rendition point, because you do say something which will shock most people in the book. And the paragraph begins, when Bill Clinton decided to start extraordinarily rendering suspected terrorists, it was therefore natural, indeed almost inevitable, that he turned to Mubarak, of course, that's Egypt, to receive many of the victims. So there's a history of rendition here. And then say something about really one of your most affecting chapters, the torture of Abu Omar, because you give the history of torture, but you also put one into tears by the time you finish that chapter.
We have been conducting, America has been conducting renditions for about a century. Simple rendition is when you go to another country, you grab someone, you bring them back to the U.S., put them on trial. And we had done that not frequently, but on and off for many decades. Well, under Clinton, his national security team suggested that rather than going through all that hassle, you have to give a guy due process, you bring him back, he may get off, who knows what, why don't we just pick him up, drop him off in some third world hellhole, and walk away? We're clean. We don't have to worry about taking him to trial. We don't have to worry about anything else. And that's why extraordinary rendition came about. And Clinton apparently, we don't know all the numbers, but Clinton apparently did dozens of these before Bush came into office. Bush accelerated the program. He may have done a couple hundred or so. We don't know the numbers on him also. Then you would have expected, based on what Obama said during the campaign, that he would have shut the whole program down. He hasn't. He's banned torture by U.S. personnel. He has refused to ban torture by proxy. So he continues to at least keep the program alive. We don't know how many people he has rendered or if he has at all, but we can assume that it is likely that he has done so. As you say, you know, when we send these people off, we're not we're sending them to places like Mubarak's Egypt, where we know they are going to be tortured. And it is a brutal, horrific torture. There are so many scenes from the book that I recount about Abu Omar's torture, and they're so horrific, it's hard to say where to begin. One that stuck with me was a particular torture where they laid him down on a mattress that they had soaked with water. And then they put two chairs, two wooden chairs, one above his knees and one above his chest, and they set two brutes on each of those chairs, heavy guys. And then they would throw an electric current through this mattress at an extremely high voltage, so high that it not only shocked him, but it threw him up off the mattress. And in doing that, he would crash into these chairs, which, you know, hurt like hell for one thing. But what it also did was to keep him from getting too far away from the mattress. So he would, you know, spring up, crash, and the second he came back down, he would be shocked again, spring up, crash, just back and forth, back and forth. This is just one. This is just one, in other words, of the many types of torture that is being done in our name daily in places like this.
Well, Steve Hendricks, the author of A Kidnapping in Milan, the CIA on Trial, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. I just wanted to conclude by saying that Abu Omar, who you describe as being tortured, had told his whole story, and then they tortured him later. And you say that they didn't do it to get the story. They had the story. They did it for retribution. It's a brilliant book, A Kidnapping in Milan, and we thank Steve Hendricks for being on Law and Disorder.
Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you all for
having me. It was great.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Law and Disorder, we've chronicled the events of Israeli forces in Gaza. Today, we're delighted to have with us Noam Chomsky, one of the world's foremost social critics, Institute Professor Emeritus in the MIT Department of Linguistics and Philosophy, and the author of many books. Today, we talked to him about his latest, Gaza in Crisis, Reflections on Israel's War Against the Palestinians. Noam Chomsky wrote Gaza in Crisis with Ilan Pappe, one of the exceptional young Israeli historians now teaching history at the University of Exeter in the UK. Noam Chomsky, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be with you.
Let's get right in and tell us why you wrote this book, why you particularly, you wrote two of the major essays in the book, particularly the one that I focused on was Exterminate All the Brutes, about the war on Gaza. And give us some perspectives that you give people in the book around the war on Gaza.
Well, actually, just to be timely, let's start with WikiLeaks.
Perfect.
Which doesn't, there's not very much of interest in it, frankly. But one of the interesting tables is, I think, the only one from the Tel Aviv embassy. It's to Clinton, and it discusses the, it's giving her sort of talking points, discusses the attack on Gaza. That's what it's about. And it tells her that Israel had to attack in December 2008 in self-defense because Hamas had violated the truce. Now, there's only two possibilities. Either the U.S. Embassy in Israel is so clueless that nobody even reads the press, or else they're just lying flat out, because the facts are clear and uncontroversial. In December 2008, Hamas was calling for a renewal of the truce that Israel had broken, and the Israeli cabinet considered it, rejected it, because they wanted the bomb. And I should add that's U.S.-Israel, because these are joint activities. in fact, that's what happened. I mean, there was a truce established in June 2008. Israel never lived up to it. They insisted on maintaining the siege in violation of the truce agreement, but nevertheless, Hamas lived up to it scrupulously. Israel officially recognizes, officially, that there was not a single Hamas rocket until November 4th. On November 4th, Israeli troops invaded Gaza, killed half a dozen Hamas militants. There was rocket firing in response, and huge Israeli rocket firing went on for a couple of days, and as usual, the casualties were all Palestinian. Then the truce did run out in December, and then what happened is what I described. Hamas called repeatedly to even institute more rigorous truce agreements, and Israel rejected it, and then the U.S. and Israel attacked. Now, the fact that, you know, this can pass without comment tells you quite a lot. In fact, I could go on to say that in the whole WikiLeaks episode, in my opinion, the most remarkable fact is the absolute contempt for democracy that's revealed by the embassies, by the State Department, and by the commentators. If you take a look at the leaks, the really dramatic leak that was repeated all over the place, headlines, articles, etc., is that the way it's put is the Arabs world wants us to bomb Iran, you know, is afraid of Iran. Well, there's a minor point and a major one. The minor point is they're, of course, just citing the Arab dictators, and we don't know what they think. We don't know how the embassy officials selected or maybe invented what they wanted to hear, which is quite normal. But let's say it's all true. They are citing the Arab dictators. Even quite brutal. What about the Arab population? Now, again, either they are clueless and don't know a thing about the Middle East, or else they're lying. I mean, we have good studies of Arab public opinion from mainstream, very respectable sources. The Brookings Institute released its last extensive poll a couple of months ago, and it has a lot about this. It says that the Arabs do perceive a threat. 88% of them see the main threat as Israel. 77% see the main threat as the United States. Iran is mentioned way down at the bottom. 10% see a threat from Iran. In fact, they're so opposed to U.S. policy that a majority, 57%, think that the region would be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons. For in our intellectual culture, what the population thinks is irrelevant. What we care about is what the dictators think, or what they say they think. This is pretty striking. I haven't seen a word about this anywhere.
Going to Gaza for another second, because you'd written your chapter, I believe, before the Goldstone Report came out. This is the chapter in Gaza in Crisis,
yeah.
Exterminate All the Brutes. And I'm interested in both your reaction to the Goldstone Report and, of course, the state's reaction, the U.S. particularly.
Well, I'm kind of ambivalent about it. They did a very good job, I think, as well as you can do when you're investigating a past war you don't have access. It's been blocked. Israel refused to allow them any access and so on. So they did a pretty good job, but it's inherently difficult to really demonstrate that crimes took place in battle. You know, that you can always say, well, you know, how do you know some Hamas gunman wasn't hiding behind a door or something? The most critical issue is the one you just discussed. Did Israel have any right to use force in the first place? Any right? Discussed almost universally as, well, sure, they have a right of self-defense. But that's not the issue. Of course, everyone has a right of self-defense. The question is, do you have a right of self-defense by force? And, you know, the law and common sense are quite clear about that. You don't have that right if you haven't exhausted peaceful means. And in this case, Israel refused even to try peaceful means. And the reason is they knew they'd succeed. that had gone back to a truce in which there were no rockets. Well, that being the case, the whole discussion's irrelevant. I mean, yeah, maybe they committed war crimes in the course of the attack. In fact, I'm sure they did, and Goldstone gives good evidence. I mean, they basically granted them a gift. If Israel wasn't so irrational, what they would have done is welcome the Goldstone report. Thank you for agreeing with us that we were right and justified in attacking Gaza implicitly. And then they would have published, you know, a couple of thousand pages, which nobody would have looked at, going through each detail.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, the Goldstone report does not address at all. It just passes over Israel's self-defense.
And we know why, incidentally. Goldstone himself had a long interview with Bill Moyers, in which Moyers asked him, what about, were they justified? He says, sure, they were justified in attacking. They just, it's disproportionate. And that's the way almost everything was reported. I mean, even the human rights groups. They just granted them the right to attack and said, well, it was disproportionate. And that's a little bit like saying that the Russian invasion of Afghanistan was disproportionate. I mean, that's not the way we deal with it.
We're speaking with Noam Chomsky, who's just published Haymarket Books, came out with Gaza in Crisis, Noam Chomsky and Ilan Pappé. It's a very, very fine book. Noam, you were somebody concerned with Israel and its fate from the very beginning when you were a young man, just like Michael and I were visited there in the 50s, and it's been something that's been part of our lives as we've grown up and old. And it gets increasingly dismaying. What do you tell people when they ask you, what sort of solutions should we look for? One state, two state, binational state? Where are we at and what can we do?
All of them. In fact, I'd even go on and prefer a no-state solution.
I agree with that.
I don't see any reason to honor the imperial boundaries. In fact, you know, when my wife and I were in Israel in the early 50s, we were hitchhiking up in the north, and you know, we happened to cross the Lebanese border, and some guy in a jeep came by and started screaming at us and told us to get back. But why have a border cutting the Galilee in half? So, and supporting all of these proposals makes perfectly good sense, as long as we recognize that you have to have a way to get there. Now, I know of only one way to proceed. If anyone has a different suggestion, I'd be happy to hear it. The only way I know is for the United States to join the rest of the world and stop its rejectionist opposition to the huge, overwhelming international consensus, agree to a two-state settlement, in which case Israel would have to go along. And then, you know, there are details to be worked out, but the basic form of it is very well understood and accepted overwhelmingly by every relevant actor except the United States and Israel. After that, my feeling is that it would come to be recognized, everyone in the former Palestine, Mandatory Palestine, Jordan to the sea, that drawing a line through that territory makes absolutely no sense. Commercial relations would pick up, social relations, cultural relations, you know, going across the border to a restaurant, whatever it may be. And I think the borders would erode naturally, in natural ways, actually the way that's beginning to happen in Europe. And okay, then you could move towards a binational federation of some sort, what people call one state. And after that, you could overcome the imperial borders. I mean, why not have integration with Lebanon?
Well, Noam, why is it that the United States defies international opinion and doesn't go along? Some people argue that it's the Israeli lobby here. Others say, no, it's in the interests of the ruling elites in the United States to keep Israel as their cat's paw. I mean, what's your view of why they don't go along?
Look, the Israeli lobby is a strong lobby, no doubt. And I really wish those claims were true. I mean, if those claims were true, it would save me a huge amount of time and effort. I could stop spending a huge amount of time giving talks and traveling and getting involved in organizing efforts and, you know, writing and so on. I could just put on a coat and tie, jacket and tie, I've got them somewhere, go to the corporate offices of Intel, Morgan Chase, or whatever, you know, Lockheed Martin, and explain to the Chamber of Commerce, you know, and explain to them politely that their interests are being harmed by this little lobby that they can put out of business in 5 seconds. okay, then it would be over. That's the tactical conclusion from the belief that the law. Now, the fact of the matter is quite different. The strongest support for Israeli crimes is coming from the business world. I mean, the most rabid supporter of Israel in the media is the Wall Street Journal. And they're not part of AIPAC. You know, that's the journal of the business world. The Republicans are far more extreme than the Democrats, even though Jewish votes and Jewish money overwhelmingly go to the Democrats. They're the more extreme of the two business-oriented parties. So it goes across the board. I mean, Intel, for example, is building its biggest plant in the world for new generation chips in Israel. The military industry, which has a huge lobby, of course, are delighted with Israel. So, for example, when the U.S., when Obama offers another $3 billion worth of jets, which will end up being twice that probably to Israel, does Lockheed Martin mind? In fact, they love it doubly because then Saudi Arabia comes along and says, we want something. So Obama offers them $60 billion worth of military equipment that they can't use in the biggest sale ever. So for them, it's just delightful. And in fact, the U.S. military and intelligence are tightly integrated with Israel. Actually, that goes back to 1948. There's archival material, which people are finally beginning to work on, which shows that in 1948, the Joint Chiefs of the U.S. military were pretty impressed by Israel's military efficiency and thought this could be a good base for U.S. power. It goes on. After 67, it just took off. Furthermore, after 1967, the intellectual community, they just had a love affair with Israel. They loved this demonstration of Israeli power, and you have to remember that was right at the peak of the Vietnam War, when, despite what people claim now, liberal opinion was very upset about the fact that the U.S. wasn't winning the war. And here came Israel along, and it showed how to deal with third world upstarts. In addition to that, Israel performed a real service to the United States. There had been an ongoing conflict between radical Islamic fundamentalism, which the U.S. was supporting, the U.S. and Britain, and secular nationalism, which the U.S. was strongly opposing. It's Nasser. The U.S. was supporting Saudi Arabia, of course, for all the oil. There was concern that Nasserite secular nationalism might try to gain control of the oil resources and use them for regional development, not for enriching the dictators and the West and the petroleum companies. And Israel destroyed it. It destroyed secular Arab nationalism. And that was a tremendous gift. That's when U.S.-Israeli relations really took off in their current form, increased later, 1970, during Black September, when the Jordanian army was slaughtering Palestinians. It looked for a while as if Syria might intervene to protect the Palestinians. The U.S. didn't want that, regarded it as a threat to the oil monarchies. But the U.S. was all tied up in Cambodia at that point. They couldn't do a thing. Israel mobilized and compelled Syria to withdraw, and the massacre continued. The U.S. Aid to Israel, I think, almost quadrupled after that. And so it continues.
Your point was driven home to me when I was over there before the first Intifada on a National Lawyers Guild delegation with Abdin Jabara. We were investigating the Israelis snatching secular Arab leaders. These were not particularly political people, you know, artists and writers, doctors, snatching them in the middle of the night from their homes and setting them out into the desert because these were like secular figures in the community and they didn't want any kind of leadership.
It was way back. In fact, yeah. Israel supported Hamas in the early days. Israel used to bus students from the Islamic universities to Beer Sheva, a secular university, to break up student strikes and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Noam, you mentioned that when we asked about possibilities for change, that the United States really had to join the rest of the world with regard to Israel and Palestine and come down directly for a solution. And when you read now every day, it seems to me that more and more Palestinian land is just being gobbled up, both in East Jerusalem as well as in the West Bank. And, of course, we have the prison of Gaza. It seems to me getting less likely that the United States is going to do that, although world opinion is shifted even more in favor of the United States doing something. So what do you make of the current attempt to do negotiations today, of all the stuff about stopping settlements and, well, everything you read in the normal paper every day?
Well, what you read in papers is, I'm sorry to say it, but it's just farcical. I mean, if there were serious negotiations going on, they would be run by some neutral party, and one side would be the world, and the other side would be the U.S. and Israel. I mean, that's what the conflict is. As far as the, you know, what's supposed to be a conflict between the U.S. and Israel is a joke. It's about expansion of settlements. First of all, Obama's position is just repeating the wording of the famous roadmap, which is supposed to be the agreed position on steps to be taken. And the first stage of the roadmap says no expansion of settlements, even natural growth. Bush repeated that. That's, in fact, more or less his administration's plan. And Obama's repeating it. But is he going to do anything about it? Well, we know. Bush, number one, he at least imposed some very mild sanctions when Israel was expanding settlements in ways that he and Baker didn't like, cut back on loan guarantees. Obama was asked about that. So are you going to do anything about it? And his spokesperson at the press conference said, no, we're not going to impose any penalties like Bush number one did. Our position is completely symbolic. Well, that's telling Benjamin Netanyahu, do whatever you like. We'll continue funding them and give you the diplomatic support and the military support and so on. So do what you like. In other words, we're saying stop, but with a wink. Wink says go ahead. That's traditional. And now it's even more extreme. Furthermore, the whole issue of settlement expansion is a minor footnote. I mean, Israel already controls about 42% of the West Bank. And in fact, in the area that Israel totally controls, Area C, living conditions are alleged to be worse than Gaza by the international agencies that have been looking. So, yeah, maybe they'll expand it a little more, but they've already got everything they want. They can take more. Obama, in fact, just offered them a bit more in the Jordan Valley, which they'll, of course, gladly pick up. Already keeping Palestinians out of them. The issue is the settlements, not expansion. They're all illegal. That's understood. Israel recognized it back in late 1967. Their leading legal authority, Theodore Meron, very respected international jurist, advised them that any settlement in the occupied territory is in violation of the Geneva Conventions, the core of international humanitarian law, instituted, incidentally, to criminalize Nazi actions. The Attorney General in Israel, Shimshon Shapira, he agreed. He said, yes, it's illegal. Moshe Dayan, who was in charge of the occupied territories, defense minister, he agreed too. He said, sure, it's in violation of law, but the countries violate law, so we'll go ahead, which means as long as the master in Washington condemns it with a wink, who cares? That's been underscored by Security Council resolutions, by the International Court of Justice. In fact, the U.S. Justice on the court filed a separate declaration that he basically agreed. He said that the Geneva Conventions applied to the occupied territories, meaning all settlement is illegal. In fact, not only is it illegal, but it violates any change. I mean, it's designed carefully. You know, they think. It's designed carefully to ensure that there cannot be any viable Palestinian self-determination. And that's the Sharon plan. Sharon called it, he said, we'll leave them Bantustans. And in fact, that's an exaggeration because South Africa needed the black population.
Yeah.
So they, you know, they kind of... And furthermore, the U.S. and Israel, and this is crucial, for about 15 years now, have been working hard to separate Gaza from the West Bank. That is in direct violation of the wording of the Oslo agreements. And that's quite important. And by now, that's virtually achieved. Well, all of this makes Palestinian self-determination almost meaningless as long as the U.S. persists in this policy.
In your book, you refer to the Palestinian Authority, or maybe Abbas, with the use of the word Quisling. Can you just explain to our listeners what that is and why you think that of the PA? Oh, but, it might have been Pape. Okay.
It is, actually.
You're right. I apologize.
There's something to it. You know, in fact, just take the way they're viewed by the United States, which is what's important. Obama's point man on the Middle East is John Kerry, head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He gave an important speech on this, the main speech from the administration on Israel-Palestine. It was at the Brookings Institute. About a year ago. He said that Israel, of course, had described the United States as an honest broker, you know, trying hard, and so on and so forth. But putting aside the sort of patriotic imagery, he said something important. He said, for the first time, Israel has a legitimate negotiating partner, the Palestinian Authority. And then he gave the reason. The reason is that there's an army in the West Bank run by a U.S. general, Keith Dayton. He's now been replaced. The Dayton armies, it's supported by the Jordanian dictatorship and by Israel. They all take part in training it and so on. And the army, he said, has proven itself very effective. And he gives one example. During the Israeli invasion of Gaza, the army was so effective that it put down any demonstrations in the West Bank, insert any sign of opposition to the attack. And General Dayton himself later said that we were so effective that Israel was able to take forces out of the West Bank and send them to attack Gaza. Well, what's the right word for that?
Quisling. Noam Chomsky, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We urge our listeners to go out and get the new Haymarket book, Gaza in Crisis, that Noam wrote along with the great Israeli historian Ilan Pappe. It's a very fine book, and people should have this on their bookshelves, and they should read it and study it. So thanks, Noam. We certainly appreciate your being on the show.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you, Noam. If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook.